You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we hear from the mother of one of the perpetrators of the Columbine Massacre about her efforts to promote brain health and suicide prevention.
First, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis said, publicity is justly commended as a remedy for social and industrial diseases. Sunlight is said to be the best of disinfectants. And this is Sunshine Week, a time each year that promotes government transparency and therefore accountability.
Watchdogs on the state and federal level take the opportunity to assess how open and responsive different government agencies are to the media and the public. One of those watchdogs joins us now. Bill Leaders is the president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, a statewide group that works to protect public access to meetings and records. Bill, good to have you back on the show.
Glad to be here.
All in all, how does Wisconsin stack up to other states, to the federal government, to the actual laws that govern our open records and public access?
Well, it's difficult to compare to other states because it's a mixed bag. I would say clearly that Wisconsin's tradition of open government is better protected and preserved and honored than it is at the federal governmental level. It hasn't been good at the federal level for many years. And although Obama did put some additional teeth into the Freedom of Information Act, it remains a relatively weak instrument because people violate it with impunity.
And Governor Walker, about a year ago, issued an executive order about open and transparent government. What was he looking for there?
Well, one of the things that the governor did in March of 2016 was to set internal time limits for responding to records requests. These aren't in the statute, but he said for state agencies he wanted them to acknowledge requests within a day and to fulfill simple requests within 10 days and to give people a response for an update within 5 days. He set these as internal standards for Wisconsin state agencies. After a year, there's been some study as to what the impact of that was. And Wisconsin State Journal did a story in Sunday's paper in which it tracked compliance of state government agencies with records requests, and it found that there was a significant improvement in response time, that overall requests are being answered a little bit faster than they were before this executive order of last year.
And the majority of people listening, I'm guessing, have never and will never file an open records request. Can you talk about why these are important to the public in keeping government accountable?
Well, there are thousands, many thousands of records requests that are made, not just by media. In fact, media are a minority of requesters, but businesses and concerned citizens interested in issues will ask for documentation from the government. The governor's office gets a lot of requests. People want to know what he's hearing from people on this issue or that issue. And so it's important that state residents are able to obtain documents when they request it. The law says they're entitled to it, but the practice is that often it takes a good long time. That's really one of the biggest problems that we've seen, is that the time it takes to get a record is often way too long. And I just said that overall there was improvement according to a study. Well, the Gannett papers also looked at this, and they found that there are still some agencies that do take an awful long time to respond to requests, one of them being the governor's office. And he says he gets more complicated request. The state attorney general's office has a long response time. Department of Corrections, which my group gave a negative award this year for a number of reasons, that has a long response time on requests. So it varies greatly between agency, and one hopes that with the new executive order that Governor Walker issued last week, that agencies, when they're forced to report their response times in a public medium where they can be analyzed, that they're going to make an effort to do better, which is what they should be doing. They should be directing more resources in order to handle requests better and more promptly.
Talking to Bill Leaders from the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council on Sunshine Week, looking at access to open records and public government information. Bill, we've been talking about that order applied to basically the executive branch, state agencies. How is Wisconsin's state legislature when it comes to open records?
Legislature is much worse. The legislature has not shown any real interest in trying to improve access to meetings or records. The legislature alone is exempt from the open meetings requirement, in that you can take a majority of members, as long as they're all members of one party, and they can go into closed session in secret. Legislators are also exempt from the retention rules that are in place for every other public official in Wisconsin. Every other state and local government official has to retain records. Members of the legislature can destroy them at will, and some of them do. They got a communication from a constituent or from a lobbyist. They read it and they delete it, and they're not breaking any law. That's tragic, and there's ample opportunity and ample issue on which the legislature could make improvements if it was so inclined. They're posted on our website. It's called Legislative Wish List. Anyone can go to the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council website and see the things that we would like the legislature to do to improve transparency in the state of Wisconsin.
Did things used to be more transparent in the legislature? Are these recent changes, or has it always been this way?
Well, I will say this, is that in July of 2015, when the legislature tried to take an axe to our openness laws in the budget by sticking in a bunch of provisions at the last minute and hoping to sneak it through, that I was shocked by that, that I didn't think that was what members of our state legislature would be doing, even though they could be doing. And it kind of made me realize that there is such a thing as an enemy of open government in the state. There are enemies of open government in the state of Wisconsin. I kind of tried to say, well, you know, we've had a long tradition of openness, and most public officials are on board, and most of them respect the right of the public to know in the majority of circumstances. I'm not so sure I feel that way. I feel that there are actual enemies to openness who will seek to take away information if they can.
I want to check out what you think about how local governments do, city, county, village, that sort of thing.
It varies. It's all over the place. I do think that one of the keys for local governments is training, that a lot of local government officials, school board officials, they don't really know what the rules are and what their obligations are under the law. And so sometimes things get denied because they just don't know that they're supposed to be turning them over.
As we wrap up, Bill, a wish list, what is one thing you'd like to see changed about open records access here in Wisconsin?
Well, it's actually open meetings is, I think, the area we'd like to really make progress in this next legislative session. Currently, if a body goes into closed session, they're supposed to state a reason, and then they're supposed to stick only to this topic that they went into closed session for. But there's no way to prove what they talk about in closed session, so they could be breaking the law. What we would like is for them to turn on a tape recorder so that if someone wants to challenge a closed session, that recording can be reviewed in camera by a judge to see whether they obeyed the law. Very simple change that could be made in our law, and it would improve openness throughout the state.
We'll leave it there for now. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Bill Leaders, president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. It's a statewide group that works to protect public access to meetings and records. He's with us to talk about Sunshine Week and how Wisconsin does when it comes to access to public information. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. On April 20th, 1999, the nation and the world watched in horror as the massacre unfolded at Columbine High School in Colorado. As details emerged of the 15 lives lost that day, including those of the killers, people blamed violent movies and video games, bullying, heavy metal music, and easy access to weapons, along with inattentive and indulgent parenting.
From the moment that she learned her son was one of the killers, up to today, Sue Klebold has been trying to make sense of that tragedy, to come to terms with the boy she thought she knew and yet could take the lives of fellow students and a teacher, as well as his own.
Sue Klebold has gone on to work for mental health awareness and violence prevention. She's the author of the book, A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. Sue, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, you have said that you feel what you call a moral imperative to share your story with the world. Why is that? Why do you feel that moral imperative?
It's very difficult to be the mother of a killer. And I felt that having this horrible, sad, and tragic event changed me significantly, and it changed my awareness about health and about communication and about many things. And I just felt that it was my responsibility to share what I had learned. Perhaps that's because I had been a teacher, and I always feel that it's my responsibility to share knowledge.
Is it your hope that what you have learned can prevent future tragedies, or is it also, to, in a sense, to bear witness?
It's everything. It's both of those things. The chances that someone you love would be involved in something as terrible as this or be the perpetrator of a mass shooting, the chances are one in millions. But the chances that someone you love may be struggling with toxic thoughts or thoughts of suicide, that is a much higher percentage. And I feel that for every one of us, mental health issues will be a part of our life in some way at some time. And I think that it's something that we should all know more about and be aware that regardless of how people act, they can be suffering greatly behind the mask that they wear.
And you've been struggling with how to reconcile your love as a mother for a son and, in a way, a life, a whole family life that you had before Columbine, before the shooting, and also the son you had who was a mass shooter who took lives. And I wonder if you could start by telling us about the first Dylan, the Dylan that you knew and loved before the tragedy.
The Dylan that I knew from the time he was just a tiny guy was very cherubic. He, you know, he had blonde, curly hair and blue eyes, and he was impish, and he was extremely smart and clever, and he could, you know, he was doing equations with magnets on the refrigerator when he was still wearing a diaper at night. I mean, he was smart. He sort of taught himself everything, how to read. When he was 4 years old, he was reading books like Charlotte's Web and Stuart Little silently to himself. It seemed that everything in Dylan's life came easily to him, and he was somebody who had such a zest for life. He loved to learn. He loved to discover. He loved origami, and he played chess, and he, you know, loved mazes and puzzles. He would dump all of the puzzles into a huge pile and work five of them at the same time because he wanted the extra challenge. I marveled at this child. He made me feel like the best parent in the world because he required very little discipline and guidance because he seemed to know how to live his life and live it well, and everything, most things, came very easily to him.
And on the other side of things, there was a Dylan that you didn't know, that he kept very private, and you saw in what's been called the basement tapes, video of him, a son you hadn't seen before, and a very anguished, depressive Dylan in some of his own writings. What did you make of that person who was also your son, but a person that you hadn't known?
When Dylan reached adolescence, he changed a lot. He became much more shy. He was always an introvert, but I could see that he was extremely uncomfortable in his own skin, as many teens are. His joy for learning abated. He didn't have that thirst for learning new things. I saw this as normal teen behavior. What was happening with Dylan was, I thought he was transitioning into adulthood in a normal way, becoming more sensitive, more self-conscious, but the things that were happening in his mind were very dangerous, and I didn't see this until after, not only after this incident happened, but until long after it happened, when I was finally able to see his writings and see that he was expressing his own level of agony. He would say, "I am in agony." He wrote about cutting himself and wanting to die and wanting to get a gun 2 years before he died. And what I really felt on discovering these things was just anguish, that my son had been suffering and I didn't help him. I didn't make him better. I didn't find a way to save him. And primarily that is what I felt, was my own terrible feelings of guilt and self-loathing that this had happened and that my son was suffering and I hadn't been able to do anything about it.
And I think that aspect is what terrifies parents. You've said that the other parents sometimes read your book so that they can maybe figure out what happened in the case of Dylan and the Columbine shooting and maybe avoid it. And on the one hand, you're saying maybe you can't always know. What do you think parents should take away from this?
What I tell parents and what I hope parents will take away from this, there are several messages. One is we have this belief system sometimes as parents that if we love our children enough, that our love is protective of them, and that if we love them and we tell them we love them, then they would never feel despondent enough to do any kind of violent act toward themselves or someone else. And that, I would say, I learned is a myth, that we can't love away depression. We can't love away these suicidal feelings and thoughts. It takes more than love. The other thing I encourage parents to do, and this is things I regret that I did not do, was the manner in which we talk to our children and we listen to our children. We must do a better job. Most of us, when we speak with our children, we are very quick to try to help them feel better, to fix what they're feeling. You know, we're going to get on this. We're going to take you to a counselor. What we, most of us, certainly I did, and other parents I've spoken with, were very uncomfortable asking our children to share with us just how much they are hurting and what their issues are. Very few of us are comfortable asking our children if they feel suicidal, if they're feeling like they wish they could go to sleep and not wake up, because that is a very difficult thing to say. But the experts are telling us that that is a necessary part of our conversation. If we observe things that show that our kids are hurting, or there's a change in behavior or sleep patterns, or if they're talking about giving away their possessions or wishing that they could not be here, it is very important to ask that question of whether or not someone is thinking of ending their lives. Now, Dylan did not display those things in front of me, but he was showing some of those signs to different people. For example, he purchased a gun, and just the acquisitions of firearms is an indication that someone might be planning their own death. And he had friends that knew that, but we as parents did not.
Now, going back to these two Dylans, the one you knew and loved and the one you didn't know so well, you've done so much processing. Are you closer to being able to reconcile the two of them?
I think I am, and I think I have. What I eventually came to in my mind was that, and many people would be are going to be offended by what I'm going to say, but in my mind, Dylan was experiencing some kind of a brain health issue that impaired his access to the tools that would have helped him cope with this, recover from this, get away from it. So in my mind, Dylan became ill, and he was a victim of the tragedy that he helped perpetrate. And when I have talked with other survivors of suicide loss, when their loved one did not kill other people but died by suicide, that is the way most of us have come to think of it, is that a brain health condition of some kind took our loved one away from us.
We're talking with Sue Klebold right now, the mother of Dylan Klebold, one of the two shooters at Columbine High School in 1999 who killed 13 people before ending their own lives. Her book is called A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. And the author's shares of the profit from that book are going toward mental health awareness and suicide prevention. So you advocate for use of the term brain health instead of mental health. Why do you like that phrase and feel that it's more helpful in addressing these issues?
One of the experts I talked to introduced that concept to me, and I thought it was very wise. When we think of mental illness, we have hundreds of years of stigma around that term. It's a very loaded word. Mental illness are very loaded words and concepts. Most of us have a lot of gut-level reactions to that, fear, of misunderstandings. When I think of brain health rather than mental health, it takes it out of the realm of mind and more into the concept of biology. Because I feel that much of what goes on when one is having issues, mood disorders, other kinds of mental illnesses, it is a brain health issue, and the brain is an organ in our body. It affects not only our thoughts and our minds, but it has a biological connection to our sympathetic nervous system. It is a brain health issue, and I think if we start looking at these things in a more holistic manner and thinking about This is something that happens to one's brain, where they cannot think and reason the way we do, or they see the world differently than we do, then I think it kind of destigmatizes it and helps us think about it a little bit differently and a little bit more concretely.
With the distance of almost two decades. Have you been able to forgive your son, to forgive Dylan, or to forgive yourself?
Forgiving Dylan was never anything I felt that I had to do, other than a very brief time after his death when I saw the basement tapes and I saw how this tremendous level of depravity and sadism and anger and all these horrible behaviors that he exhibited at the time of his death. But after I came to grips with thinking about what Dylan was experiencing in his mind, what were the influences in his life, I got to read his writings, and they were not filled with hate and planning for murder. They were full of love and longing. And the peace that has stayed with me is not the need to forgive Dylan for what he did. It is the need to forgive myself. And there is a piece of me that I will never forgive not being the mother that Dylan needed me to be. But the way I cope with that is I'm doing the things that I do. You know, I have written a book and could donate my share of the profits. I try to speak. I try to talk with other parents to help other survivors of loss. I kind of feel that, in a way, that paying it forward and trying to change things is something I can do to help myself, to forgive myself.
Sue, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Sue Klebold is the mother of Dylan Klebold, one of two shooters at Columbine High School in 1999, who killed 13 people before ending their own lives. She's now an advocate for mental health awareness and violence prevention. She's the author of the book, A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. The news is next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. 20 years ago, the television series Buffy the Vampire Slayer hit the airwaves. The show ran for 7 seasons and followed title character Buffy as she fought demons and vampires with her high school friends in Sunnydale, California, the site of the Hellmouth.
But the show didn't just chronicle the friends' adventures. The series tackled a whole range of themes, including feminism, sexuality, authoritarianism, and more, under a veil of sometimes campy fun.
James South joins us now to talk about the Buffy anniversary. He's an associate professor of philosophy at Marquette University and co-editor of the book Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Philosophy, Fear and Trembling in Sunnydale. James, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, what first got you into the Buffyverse?
Well, I had a lot of friends telling me I should watch the show, and I thought it sounded really silly. And the next thing I knew, I started watching it. And before I knew what had happened, I was starting to write about it. And it's the first TV show that had ever made me think about writing about it. So that's what got me started, was just watching it.
Your main academic area, as I understand, is medieval and Renaissance philosophy. What is it about a show like Buffy the Vampire Slayer that, from a pop culture angle, can get us talking and thinking about philosophical issues?
Well, I think you mentioned them all in the introduction. The questions of authoritarianism, the questions of racism and sexism, and misogyny, all of those sorts of topics, the role of friendship versus family, choosing your friends, choosing your family. There are so many questions that get raised in that context that over the course of 7 seasons, the show just explores in incredible detail.
The show on the one level could be seen as pretty campy. I mean, the setup is pure camp. You've got this girl who's sort of on the cheerleader track, only she ends up being chosen to slay vampires and fight back forces of evil. It sounds like it's just going to be fun, but then the show ends up tackling serious topics and it ends up making them feel really resonant and real. How does it walk both those lines?
Well, it works on multiple levels. I mean, there's the surface level of the dialogue, the wittiness, the neologisms, the way they come up with words to talk about. I mean, there's actually a book out there called Slayer Slang, written by a linguist that talks about just how inventive the language is and the way they converse with one another in a kind of shorthand that also pulls the viewer in. But then underneath that, there's really serious things going on. The town is in peril. There are vampires. There are monsters. There are demons. And there's the underlying basic metaphor, which is, at least at the beginning of the series, that high school represents hell.
Let's give a listen to a little bit of the show on a theme of sacrifice. A pivotal scene, a fifth season, I believe, Buffy, spoiler alert to those who haven't watched, sacrifices herself to save her, spoiler alert, sister Dawn. Here's the speech that Buffy gives to her sister.
Tell Giles I figured it out, and I'm okay. And give my love to my friends. You have to take care of them now. You have to take care of each other. You have to be strong. Dawn, the hardest thing in this world is to live in it. Be brave. Live. For me.
So issues of sacrifice, bravery, duty to others, carrying on after tragedy. I mean, you can go back to ancient Greece to find this philosophy, too, and here it is on this lighthearted TV show.
Well, that's right. And you know, my contribution to the Buffy and philosophy book was actually about Buffy and Greek tragedy. I mean, I think the line in that scene that's so resonant is the line that the hardest thing in this world is to live in it. That's not something you expect from a show called Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It's not something one knows how to process when one first hears it. It's something one has to think about and think about deeply to get the full ramifications of the meaning of that line.
And the other remarkable thing, well, one of many, I guess, is that the protagonist is a girl, and she's a young woman growing up, and you've got her. She's really tough, but on the other hand, her name is Buffy, so you're invited not to take her seriously, and yet you have no choice to take her seriously on the other hand.
Well, that was always the ironic premise of the show, was instead of it being, you know, a typical male hero who's going around saving the day, a superhero like Batman or Superman or something like that, it's this petite valley girl with this unique slang, with this unique take on the world, with an insouciance. At the end of the very first two-part pilot, you know, she's wondering how she can get kicked out of school, and she talks about how important it's going to be to excessively not study, right? So, but yet she is, literally, you know, she's got the weight of the world on her shoulders. There's an episode, you know, called Weight of the World, and she just has to fight and fight and fight and fight.
It's the 20th anniversary of the show Buffy the Vampire Slayer, punched above its weight class, had a big influence on American popular culture. Talking to James South from Marquette University, a philosophy professor there, co-editor of the book Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Philosophy. You mentioned that pilot. I want to give a listener, I want to give the idea for people who haven't seen the show that it's all serious sacrifice and heroism. Here's a listen to Buffy meeting the librarian, who's more than he seems, Mr. Giles.
I believe this whole area is a center of mystical energy. The things gravitate towards it that you might not find elsewhere.
Like vampires.
Like zombies. Werewolves. Incubi. Succubi. Everything you've ever dreaded was under your bed but told yourself couldn't be by the light of day. They're all real.
What? You like Sent Away for the Time Life series?
Yes.
Did you get the free phone?
The calendar.
Go.
And there's a lot of back and forth, the serious and the funny, and the, as you mentioned, the dialogue and the relationships are a big part of the appeal, James.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, a scene like that where you see Giles, you know, just so excited about the supernatural and Buffy playing it so casual, and yet what Giles has done is really silly. It's an offer of the Time Life series on on monsters, right? So,
how much do you think Joss Whedon, how much credit should he get for making the show what it was? Because I can see an alternate universe in which the show was really, really bad and it tried to do these things, but it just didn't work. But somehow the dialogue is so snappy and the issues feel real. They don't feel forced. How much credit should we give Joss?
Well, I mean, there is a world in which this is a bad, campy movie, right? I mean, there had been a movie several years before with the same name, and it wasn't a good movie, right?
So,
I mean, I think he's the driving force. He's the one who captured the language initially. He captured the tone. He directed some of the early central episodes. But then he also had this amazing ability to pull talent into the circle of the show. And he got this great stable of writers who would just, you know, take an idea of his and run with it, come up with their own ideas, and he would tweak them and make sure everything was consistent. I mean, this really is sort of the beginning of auteur television in many ways. It's his show all the way through. No matter how much the other writers are involved, no matter how much other people direct episodes, it's his vision, it's his voice, it's his message, right?
We're talking to James South right now. He's an associate professor of philosophy at Marquette University, and we're talking about the groundbreaking series Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It debuted 20 years ago.
You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. Do you have memories of discovering this series as James did, as I did, having serious misgivings but getting sucked in anyway? What lessons did you take away from the show? And have you chosen someone, a chosen one in the next generation, to share the show with yourself? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
I've got a theory that it's a demon, a dancing demon. Nah, something isn't right there.
I've got a theory, some kid is dreaming, and we're all stuck inside his wacky Broadway nightmare.
I've got a theory we should work.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about the 20-year anniversary of Buffy the Vampire Slayer with James South. He's an associate professor of philosophy at Marquette University.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you a fan of the show? What was it that got you into it? Have you watched, maybe rewatched it over the years? What made it click for you? Do you see its footprints in other shows or movies, pop culture in general since? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And James, I want to ask you, I mean, this is something that, for instance, Rob and I watched when we were, I'm going to say growing up, or were we in our 20s?
Yeah, oh, I was
you don't
growing
want to go
up.
There.
Yeah, so I was growing up-ish. Yeah.
I wonder if it holds up now, I guess is what I'm getting at here. You know, when you're young, maybe you're ripe for this kind of thing, which can feel a little overwrought, these big issues, you're fighting good and evil. I mean, have you watched it now? Does it still hold up the way some really great shows don't seem to 20 years later?
Well, I am perhaps biased, but yes, I think it does hold up. I think the acting is still fantastic. I think the writing is still witty and not dated in any way at all. I think they made a very conscious choice to minimize technology in the show. So after the first season, you don't really see very much technology in the show, so it doesn't look dated, except occasionally in the fashion department. And so, yes, I think it's, you know, the themes resonate. I teach a course on the show from time to time. Students who, you know, were too young to watch it when it was on, watch it and find it very appealing, find it very moving, find it very something that they still relate to and that they see the influence of in so much other television. As I said, you know, this is sort of the beginning of one person running a show on a shoestring budget on a small network. You have to remember back when it aired, there were very few networks on television, and now we have all these boutique networks that show these shows like Breaking Bad or The Sopranos or any of these other shows, Mad Men, which I've also edited a book on. You had a vision. You had somebody who knew what they wanted to do and wanted to say, but they got a lot of that from Joss Whedon.
Let's go to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jennifer's with us from south of the border in Hoffman Estates. Jennifer, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, Well, I'm listening with my son, who's 13, and his name is Xander. Yeah. The series got me through my entire pregnancy.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, we watched it as a family, had a lot of fun watching it. I have to say, there's episodes that will forever stick out. The death of Buffy's mom, how Joss handled that. The love triangle between Spike and Angel. It's always topics for discussion when I find people who love the series.
And do you watch this with Xander?
Yes, he's watched the entire series, and then we moved on to Angel after that.
Jennifer, thank you so much for sharing that. I guess it's like baby Mozart, but baby Buffy, because she was watching while she was pregnant. And do you hear that a lot, people sharing it with their children, James?
Oh, I do, yes. I think people my age and younger or older share it with their children, their grandchildren. It's also the kind of show that gets passed around. I mean, I have a colleague who mocked me for years that I read on Buffy the Vampire Slayer until I finally challenged her and said, have you ever watched it? And the next thing I know, she's watched the entire series. So,
Jennifer, thanks a lot for that. I appreciate the call. And we go next to Sarah in Madison. Sarah, hi.
Hi. Hi. I just wanted to call and, you know, say that I concur. I think the show is amazing, and it does hold up over time. Both my teenage daughters and I watched it, and I was really excited when they were finally got to an age where I felt like they could handle, you know, some of the themes and whatnot. But I enjoy watching it with them because it's great entertainment, but I also think, you know, that it's she and many of the characters are just really great role models, as weird as that might sound.
Sarah, I want to ask you, now that you've watched it, now that you're older, were there parts of it that resonated differently that you maybe went over your head when you were younger, but now they kind of hit you hard?
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry I can't speak to that too much, because I was kind of a late arriver myself. It, like the guest was saying, a friend of mine turned me on to it when probably 12 years ago or so. So I had little kids, and it was kind of like a guilty pleasure that my husband and I would enjoy after they went to bed. We'd watch an episode or two. And, you know, but at the time, you know, watching it, I thought, wow, this is like so entertaining. But at the same time, there's a deepness to it. And there's some really great new things that I had never seen before in TV. And, you know, just different approaches that I really appreciated.
Sarah, thank you so much for that call. And I want to ask you, James, do you think that, maybe this is going way, way over the top, you know how with Shakespeare, you reread it, you find something new every time. Is there something like that in Buffy?
I think there is. I mean, that is every time I watch, prepare for when I'm teaching the class, when I rewatch episodes, when I just sometimes am in the mood to watch the show again. I mean, you played a little snippet from the musical. I mean, I have the soundtrack on my iPhone. I listen to the you know, I rewatch the musical episode all the time because it was something that they never should have been able to pull off, and pulled off brilliantly. And managed to advance the plot along with it and reveal something very, very important along the way. So, yeah, I think every time I rewatch it, I mean, there's the occasional clunker episode there, but most of the episodes hold up really well. And each time you see something a little different, hear something a little different, realize that something they said in season three pays off in season six, and you just go, wow, how did they remember that? They must have been watching it obsessively as well.
Sarah, thanks so much for that call. We'll go next to Tim on the line in Spring Green. Tim, hi.
Hey, guys. First of all, thank you so much for talking about this. It's wonderful to hear. I also have to add real quick that as a classical actor who does a lot of Shakespeare, that I think that Joss Whedon is in the same world, that he uses he uses history, he uses fantasy, he uses things like that to tell us important stories about what it means to be a person and to be human. And my favorite thing about the show is always that he didn't lie to you. I mean, you know, yeah, he had one of his best episodes was called Lie to Me, but he used all of these, these fantasy elements to talk about things that nobody else really talked about quite as much. I mean, you know, you have a werewolf to talk about teenage adolescent sexuality. You have, you know, Buffy when she loses her virginity, and then the boy that she loses it with changes into a demon the next day. You know what I mean? And like all this other stuff, ways of talking about all these painful experiences that we all have growing up, and just giving it that little fantastic twist so that we could see it
Tim,
more wholly.
Thanks so much. A Shakespearean actor in Spring Green. What are the odds? I want to pursue that theme by listening. Speaking of unexpected people talking about things, Anya, demon turned human, getting ready for a funeral. Buffy's mom. Here's an interaction here.
Are they going to cut the body open?
Oh, my God. Would you just stop talking? Just shut your mouth. Please.
What am I doing?
How can you act like that?
Am I supposed to be changing my clothes a lot? I mean, is that the helpful thing to do?
Guys.
The way you behave.
Well, nobody will tell me.
Because it's not okay for you to be asking these things.
But I don't understand. I don't understand how this all happens. How we go through this. I mean, I knew her, and then there's just a body. And I don't understand why she just can't get back in it and not be dead anymore. It's stupid. It's mortal and stupid. And Xander's crying and not talking, and I was having fruit punch, and I thought, well, Joyce will never have any more fruit punch ever, and she'll never have eggs or yawn or brush her hair, not ever, and no one will explain to me why.
And James, you don't have to be an ex-demon trying to understand what it means to be human to have these or similar questions when you're getting ready for a funeral.
But I think there are also questions that we so often don't ask ourselves when someone close to us dies or someone that we know dies. We don't ask about those quotidian aspects of life that they'll never enjoy again, that they will never experience again, never having fruit punch again. I've never thought about that in relation to someone who died. It took Joss to reveal that to me, right? That is, in fact, essential to the process of death. You're never going to have fruit punch again.
And we've got another caller here. Let's go next to Daniel in Platteville. Daniel, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I actually like to say Joss Whedon is an amazing writer. I mean, everything that he actually goes for and actually writes about, starting with, like, Buffy, and then all of a sudden, even into a shorter series like Firefly, he just brings like this whole another level that just keeps resonating through time. And it's great.
Daniel, thank you for that. And so Firefly, another series created by Joss Whedon. There's also that facility with language that the characters of Firefly have along with the characters of Buffy. And he sees something almost timeless, which I guess brings us back to that classical sense of drama and life and death, James.
Yes, well, the early death of Firefly is something to mourn as well. But the language of Firefly is itself unique. It's Western, it's contemporary, it's futuristic, and it's interspersed with Chinese. And the actors, the performances there, I mean, the subtext of the show is very, very dark, and yet they're funny and quippy and everything else like that. In fact, quippy may be a Buffyism, right?
And James, where do you see the descendants in the TV and movie world of Buffy the Vampire Slayer today? Who do you look to as modern examples?
Well, it's amazing how many people point to Buffy and go, you know, we didn't know we could do that with television. So, I mean, I think of somebody like Matthew Weiner who did Mad Men and used many of the actors from Buffy and Angel in that show and realized they could tell a story over multiple years, and you could follow the characters over multiple years and take themes and develop them and look at them from different perspectives. On the more contemporary scene, I'm thinking about a show like Westworld, which I'm currently working on a book about. And I mean, the questions about what it is to be human, the difference between human and machines, the responsibilities we owe to other creatures, who's evil, who isn't, the twists and the turns. And again, that's very auteur television. It's Jonathan Nolan, who's a brilliant writer and television director. And those are the kinds of descendants and offsprings, I think. Yep. Buffy set the path for being able to do that multi-layered, multi-year. You can make a reference to something that happened in season one and season seven.
Have to leave it there. Thanks to James South from Marquette University. He's written on Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Marquette will be holding an academic conference studying the show April 1st in Milwaukee. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.